So let's go right into chapter 5, verse 1. And there was a great outcry of the people and their wives against the Jewish brethren. So what's happening is we're going to see the details. Outcry there, literally, it's a big dispute. It's almost tribal in a way, but not entirely. There was a problem had popped up. Problems tend to do that. They don't magically show up. They're often underground, like a seed planted in a garden, and until it pops up and then shows what fruits on it, shows what it's going to bear, you don't sometimes know what it is, but you know it's there, but you're not sure what it is, and when it pops up, you're like, yeah, this is pretty obvious. So that's kind of what's happened. A dispute has arisen. Now let's look and see what that dispute was oriented around. For there were those who said, we, our sons and our daughters, are many. Therefore, let us get grain that we may eat and live. There were also some who said, we have mortgaged our lands and vineyards and houses that we might buy grain because of the famine. There were also those who said, we have borrowed money for the king's tax on our lands and vineyards. Catch verse 5. Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children. And indeed, we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters have been brought into slavery. It is not in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and our vineyards. And so what was happening was in the gathering, in the family, in the Jews that have, you know, they have traveled from captivity in Babylon. Many of them were even born in the Jerusalem area in this almost 100-year span from when Zerubbabel brought the first group of people out of captivity, then Ezra brought a group, and now Nehemiah shows up with a smaller entourage, really, to get things done. Well, those that were born there, the temple's been established or rebuilt, and temple practices under Ezra's leadership were taking place, but they're still very vulnerable. And it's just, they kind of got in a routine or a rut. You know what I'm talking about? They just were putting up with life. It was hard. It was tough. That's just how it is. Well, there was also economic disparity. Disparity speaks of a wide gap or a big difference between one and another. So there was those that held land and owned land and were wealthier, and those that were trying to do the work and still come up with some food for the kids. So here they're doing this work, but you know, there's things that got to be taken care of at home, and they functionally don't have money. And so there were some that were, you know, it was just we see it today, even in the church, but in the world, it's a problem that, you know, it's really tough to wrestle with when somebody is very wealthy and somebody's not. Did you guys ever notice that's true in the world? Right? I mean, that's just that's an injustice and an unfairness. And it's hard to see how this works out, especially when as Christians, we naturally, but not necessarily accurately, assume that God will bring out economic equality. Take from them and give to them and just make it all balance out and everybody will just be happy and live ever after, you know. Well, the Bible doesn't teach you that. It's just an assumption that that's what equality or fairness would produce. What had happened is those who had land and had resources were basically loaning money to those in need and charging interest. The word usury in this context is speaking of interest, and it wasn't speaking of, as some other times when this is addressed in Scripture, it wasn't talking about exorbitant interest. It was just what we'd call fair interest. But the problem is, it was actually carnality masked as spirituality. So in other words, those who had the funds and the money were, hey, we'll help you out. We'll help you with this. We'll loan you. We'll do this. And so some of them, okay, but then they were charging an interest, which would have been socially acceptable, the rate. But if you think about it, it's, here these people have traveled back and they're trying to do a good work together. And those within the group are charging others within the group to do the work. And, you know, it was just kind of like it really got under their skin, as you can imagine. And after a while, that started brewing, and it kind of kept growing. And as we'll see when we see Nehemiah's response, there was also, I think in this text we've already looked at, disunity due to self-mindedness. It's disunity due to self-mindedness. As I said, it wasn't a high interest they were charging. It wasn't the finance company at 27%. It was the neighbor at 6%. But the bottom line, it was not right in that situation, and really, we could say probably in most situations, to charge them interest on that. And so I think of 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 10, which, you know, capsulizes what's happening in this culture at that time. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. And it goes on to say, for which some have strayed from the faith in greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. So that passage out of 1 Timothy shows that, you know, sometimes when we become too money-minded and we give room for our own idea and a way to get a little more, we stray from the faith. And he says you stray, if you would, on this road or in this path of greediness. And what does it produce in a born-again Christian or in here, those who are following God wanting to, that you find yourself pierced through with many sorrows. And we're going to see that unfold a little bit because, you know, if you go on that track and you become more self-minded and everything's more, you know, about yourself, and then all of a sudden we start kind of gathering in too tight, God's design is to protect us from this, that we are not pierced through with many sorrows. So his design in tithing and giving and offerings in reference to the New Testament is actually protective, and it's not taking from. It's protecting us from worshiping stuff. It's kind of like this. God doesn't mind you having stuff. He wants to protect you from stuff having you and taking you aside and taking you off course. And so we see an example of that principle. It's summarized in 1 Timothy 6:10. We see an example of it in living color, if you would, in this particular text. So we can gauge a little more the severity of the situation in verses 1 through 5 by looking at the reaction of a man of God, this man of character, Nehemiah, found in verse 6. And I became very angry when I heard their outcry and these words. So I became very angry. Not just angry. It specifically said, this really put me over the top. Because he is laboring with them and he sees it. And now it's brought to his attention that there's those who are not only not carrying their weight, if you would, in a financial sense, but they're actually profiting off those who have almost nothing. And it really upset him. He was not just angry, but very angry. But here's an interesting thing. Notice, I became very angry. Verse 7, after serious thought, he thought about it seriously. And if you think about Psalm 4, verse 4, be angry and sin not, or be angry and do not sin. Meditate within your heart on your bed and be still. So what's that mean? You will be angry. There's certain things that if it doesn't incite you, or at least it anger you some, you might want to check how you process things. For example, you see somebody, you know, just kind of an odd example, but I think it would fit. Say you're driving down the road, just kind of out for a drive, and, you know, maybe out in the country or whatever, and there's a vehicle pulled off the side and, you know, kind of off on a little turn off. And here's this guy out in the field just beating on this kid. And you're a spiritual person. You love Jesus. So you're like, oh, honey, look at that. And you pull the car over. Let's pray for him right now. Honestly, you need to snap out of your Christian silliness. What should you do? You should be stirred enough. You're going to go over and interfere with that. You might have to knock the guy down to stop. It should anger you that such things are taking place. And sometimes I think Christians have this, we have this perception that we're supposed to be docile and passive and you know, not interfering with things. And there's certain things that should anger you. There's certain things that right now that, you know, what's happening in Africa with Christians, it should anger us. We shouldn't just say, oh, okay, I'll pray. I mean, not that we can drive, fly over there and do something about it physically, but you see what I'm saying? And there's certain things that should anger you. But be angry and do not sin. In other words, like, God, I know most of you at one point or another have just been, even where you can't rest or can't sleep some night because of terrible things that have happened to family members or friends or whatever, even yourself, and you're just, this is not right. It's an injustice. It's wrong. And so don't look at that as sin. It's what you do with it. It can become sin. Meditate within your heart. He says, yeah, just chew on this and think it through. Like, and really, we know from Nehemiah, he literally, what we would call, laid it before the Lord. He thought about it, and it was serious thought. So you guys have those serious thought moments? Here's my serious thought moments. They start out with, I will punch them in the face. But I realize that's not Christ-like. I have a my idea initially, and it's usually not balanced. It's usually not even God-honoring. It's just my reaction. I could come up with plenty of excuses, but they don't matter. And the reality is, I don't mind that if I can exercise self-control. If I can say, God, this makes me so mad. I remember, here's a case in point. It's a situation where, as a fairly young Christian, growing and just serving in ministry, serving, you know, I was working in the truck shop and serving and, you know, just, and a real close friend, his wife had just had a baby. Well, actually, she hadn't had the baby yet. She was pregnant. And Kevin was working construction, second story on an apartment complex, fell and hit head first on the concrete below. And so he was in the hospital, in a coma, obviously a bad scenario. And we did what you should do. We organized a prayer chain. We were in the hospital chapel round the clock, had every hour covered. We did everything. I mean, obviously, when you do stuff like that, you know, you're going to see a miracle because, you know, you've done your part. Kevin died. And it rocked my world. It just, like, I drove the Suburban partway up Bogus Basin Road. Pulled off, and I can't even reconcile things. Nothing in my theology, nothing in what little I knew about Scripture, nothing lined up. And I remember just parking the Suburban and just running up this dirt road. I don't even know why I ran. I think I was just so mad, so shocked, so out of it. And I remember yelling, God, I am so mad at sin. And I don't know why I said that. I was mad at the situation. I was, Kevin's wife, Lauren, gave birth to a child while he was in the hospital. She actually gave birth the day of his memorial service. And so it's just one of these, like, all these things you just can't figure out. And I'm up there and I'm so mad at sin. Kevin didn't sin and cause the accident. It was sin that brought death into the world. And I was shocked by my response because that's a good theological, spiritual response, correct? I mean, it's a really good response. I just didn't know that was in me. I really was ready to punch wind. You know what I mean? I was just, that kind of yell. And it was an anger that I realized that that anger should, there's times it should stir up, it meditate within your heart and be still. And I drove back off the hill a lot more calm than I drove up the hill. A lot more was reconciled. So notice here, he says, after serious thought, I rebuked the nobles and rulers and said to them, each of you is exacting usury from his brother. So I called a great assembly against them. He rebuked them, which means he called it as it is. It wasn't any of this, you know, passive, fuzzy Christian talk, trying to, you know, make sure they don't hurt feelings. He said, this is a mess, and you guys are doing this, and it's wrong. And he called it before an assembly. We would say, well, I think he should have met with them one-on-one. Well, you know what? It was a group thing that had happened. There was multiple people that had been wronged and multiple people doing the wrong, and he just calls this assembly, everybody together. You don't see that too much, do you? You know, and you can look into, I think, Matthew 18. Anyway, there's issues on reconciliation, and there's some great direction in the New Testament, but it stood out to me that he called them out, and he addresses it straight on, straightforward, verse 8. And I said to them, according to our ability, we have redeemed our Jewish brethren who were sold to the nations. He's referencing, according to our ability, we helped each other get over here from captivity. We were in captivity with the Gentiles, the Babylonians. And so, according to our ability, we've got here. Now, indeed, will you even sell your brethren? In a sense, will you put them back into a financial captivity, a type of servanthood? Or should they be sold to us? Then they were silenced and found nothing to say. That is a good thing. They didn't conspire together or group together and come up with some justification for their actions. There was a good thing happening. They knew it was wrong, and they realized it's wrong. And when he's called out, they didn't give lame excuses. It's really a good way to approach those type of things. When you've done wrong and there's just something that's stirring in your heart and you're kind of okay, and it gets brought up or called out, I've found being stubborn and holding the line never helps me. Because I still have to deal with it later. It just makes it more complicated. To be able to say, God, just humble me. I see this is not right. I'm sorry. You know, just openly, humbly before God. And I don't know that that's entirely their attitude, but they are receptive. You know, he goes on to say in verse 9, then I said, what you are doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? So twofold, personal, should you not walk with the awareness of God, with a reverence to God? You know, fear is speaking to revere God or hold God up. In regards to your relationship with God, you know, Mr. Individual Jew, you should be aware that you've been, because they've been convicted individually. Most of us know that conviction. When we're doing something that other people are doing and we know that it's not the right thing to do, but we justify it because other people do it, we know before God, I know they do it and it seems to be okay, but deep down it just doesn't seem right. So they had that conviction, but they also had this reminder, it's a horrible witness to the enemies around us. We know the enemies have been right in their face, interfering with the work. And they know some of what's going on. They got spies on the inside. There's some, you know, marriages that have brought union with the enemies that are causing problems. So the talk in the town was like, man, these Jews kind of, they put it to each other too. They charge them. They're supposed to be God's people. And here, look what they're doing to each other. So he's saying, you know, because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies. Now verse 10. I also, with my brethren and my servants, am lending them money and grain. Please let us stop this usury. I believe he was lending them what they needed. He wasn't funding them. He wasn't subsidizing them. He was lending to them. Why is that, in many cases, important? Why wouldn't, if he has some, just give it to them? There's a certain element that our culture has proven, and in many other cultures, when you subsidize, you enslave them differently. When you pay their way, you undermine the bare sense of value. Yes, there's times that there's a coming alongside somebody, but like in our culture where we have so much subsidy, we reward people for not working. And in a sense, we feel like we're helping them, but in reality, we're cutting their legs out from under them because we're teaching them that they can just stay home and kick back and relax and get their check. And so it's not all inclusive, you understand that, but there's clearly some in our system that we've created and then offered to citizens. Citizens have accepted the offer and ended up being turned into people with really bad habits and bad behavior. There's other people that are completely in need of the support, which I see different than I see subsidy in my brain, more subsidizing something that they could do, paying for something that they could do. So it's good to help get someone on their feet And then they lend it. They pay it back. Because what happens if you borrow something? Just think of all our lives. When you've been in a spot where you've had to borrow something, and then you use it, and then you pay them back, it kind of rebuilds you a little bit. You get humbled when you have to ask, but then being able to pay it back and kind of settle the score with gratitude and thankfulness, you're like, you get kind of built back up. And so he lended, they were lending, you know, and it says that, you know, let's stop the charging of interest. Let's stop profiting off people in tough situations. Let's stop profiting off the poor. Verse 11, restore now to them, even this day, their lands, their vineyards, their olive groves, their houses, also a hundredth of their money and the grain, the new wine, and the oil that you've charged them. In other words, give a little back. He didn't actually say give the whole whatever usury was. He said, listen, just be realistic. Just cut them loose from this obligation and this restraint and everything. And notice verse 12, their response. So they said, we will restore it and we will require nothing from them. We will do as you say. Awesome. It's great. Perfect response. But Nehemiah wasn't born the day before. Nehemiah is smart enough to know that's awesome. That's cool. Look what he says. Then I called the priests and required an oath from them that they would do according to their promise. What they said they would do, he knew there's a strong chance they will not do. And it's really sad that we're reading about the people of God, that their reputation and their action and practice was they'd say one thing and do another. So he calls them and asks, he signs a contract before the priest, so to speak, that I will do this. As I said when we started out, there are parallels in this story or this book of Nehemiah that are very active and very similar in our world today, and even in the church. When I first got saved, there was a businessman, and I'm working in the truck shop painting trucks, and there was a guy, Paul Smith. He had a company named Simsoy Smith. And Paul was old when I knew him, which means he's always old. But anyway, he'd come in and he'd letter these trucks, and he was just an artist. He would just write. Well, he kind of took me under his wing when I became a Christian, and he was really witness to me a lot as he was working, because, you know, some people like to talk to him, and he wouldn't stop and talk to him. He'd talk to him while he's working, and he goes, "I don't get paid to talk." I mean, do you guys get paid to talk? He'd say that to guys working hourly that want to stand around and talk to him. And he'd say, no, I don't get paid to talk. Do you guys get paid to talk? You know? But anyway, he took me under his wing and really kind of was just sharing with me. And we developed a really close friendship and really mentored me. But he said one time to me when we were actually on the golf course, and he said, you know, with my business, if I had to do it again, I don't know if I'd hire Christians again. And I'm fairly young, and he met me like, whoa, whoa, wait, man, why wouldn't you hire the family, the brothers, why now? And I'm like, really? And he says, yeah, because I lose 2, sometimes 3 hours every Monday. When the Christians come in and they talk about their church service and they talk about their Sunday and they talk about their stuff, that doesn't bother them to stand around and talk. These guys that got drunk on Friday night, threw up on Saturday, got drunk again Saturday night, you know, suffered in misery on Sunday, knowing they had to go to work on Monday, they come in afraid they'll get fired if they don't do their work. The Christians think because we're family, you can't do anything about it. And, you know, I thought, well, that's an oddity. That's probably just a rare guy. No, it's really sad that that's not so uncommon. Many business owners, many people that I have engaged with, and many people that I worked with, the Christians were not driven to do their work like they should. They were the ones that were too slack, too much say they would do it and not do it. We even see it in the church. People are more apt to say they'll do something and not do it in the church than they are at work. You know, someone will say, hey, I'll be there, or I'll do this, and they'll respond out of fear of reprimand and ridicule and go to their commitment. But we're sometimes in the church gathering, it's like, oh, yeah, I just didn't make it. You see what I'm saying? We should respond with love and respect in a higher proportion than we would to fear and reprimand. But it's just something that's like, it's always strange to me as we seek God and we want to grow. Be aware that, you know, these are people that chose to go to Jerusalem. There was a small percentage that went, and this is them. And they got there and they got into complacency and they allowed carnality to creep in, and they're getting called out for it in a really good way. So here we go. He has them sign on the dotted line, but then he takes it one step further, if you would. He made him sign before the priests. And then Nehemiah, we see in verse 13, "Then I shook out the fold of my garment and said, so may God shake out each man from his house, from his property, who does not perform this promise. Even thus may he be shaken out and emptied." And all the assembly said, "Amen," and praised the Lord. Then the people did according to this promise. It's an interesting picture, because some believe that because he's still representing the king, he's like a governor in the area, as we'll see. And so he would have had his government uniform. He's working, but yet he's also, you know, one of them. And so when he stands up and shakes off his garment, anything that settles on your lap or whatever, it's basically conveying this picture. Everything that settled on me is now cast from me. And so he's saying to them, and if you would, he gives them a picture warning them. And of course, I think the assembly speaks of what was mentioned earlier. Those who were called out on it responded, but the assembly said, yeah, that's the way it should be. Because they're getting freed from this injustice and this economic weight. What do we call this whole scenario? Let's just call it like it is: awkward, uncomfortable, difficult. Just, it's awkward. And what's the best thing to deal with? How best way to deal with those things? Just deal with them. You know, granted, the timing's necessary and that, but too often we avoid the awkward so we can have some more uncomfortable. And it's sometimes best just to deal with it straight on in a kind and compassionate way. I know he was not overbearing. Now, let's continue on in verse 14. "Moreover, from the time I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year until the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the governor's provisions. But the former governors who were before me laid burdens on the people and took from them bread and wine besides 40 shekels of silver. Yes, even their servants bore rule over the people, but I did not do so because of the fear of God." We see this strength of character. We see who he is as a person. It's character revealed. You know, the governors were, you know, government, so they were supported, you know, by practice. It wasn't a taxation type basis like we would do, but it's functionally the same thing. And they could demand more, and their servants could demand more. And Nehemiah, from the time he got there, he didn't do that. The cost of this rebuild, for a great portion of it, appears to have been funded by King Artaxerxes. He was given resources, and then he was also given security once he crossed the river Euphrates. And so now that he's here, he doesn't, you know, kind of capitalize on the situation. He just said, okay, we're not going to charge him more. I think he's seen, listen, this is what's going on. I'm not going to draw a big wage when these people are just scraping to get by. I wish our government had that mindset as well sometimes. Doesn't seem to. So as he says that, now notice it says in verse 16, "Indeed, I also continued the work on this wall, and we did not buy any land. All my servants were gathered there for the work." Interesting comment, huh? "And we did not buy any land." Think about what we know as far as land values and location, 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 and the various variables in that. What's the state of Jerusalem? What's the land value? In the tank. It's way down there because of the whole thing. Now, what's it going to be like when the walls are rebuilt, when there's security, when there's commerce, when there's things going through? They're going through the roof. Now, that's a basic principle. It's not rocket science. They did not buy land. Him and his leaders did not buy land. That speaks a lot about because this would have been a really easy thing, and he could have even sold it, so to speak, as, hey, I will help you out. You've got that extra 5 acres over there, and I'll tell you what, I know things are tight, but I will make a sacrifice and buy that from you so you have enough money to take care of your kids. I really appreciate that you're working on the wall. You can continue on the work. It's an easy sales pitch. Most people go, yeah, that's a good point. But it's not right where. Before God. That's what he identifies. You know, I didn't want to do this. It says, let me find it again, verse 15. But I did not do so because I revere God. Because he knew my relationship with God is more important than my financial gain or my portfolio or my acquisitions or whatever I can do. I'm concerned about this, him and me first. And he knew in his heart, this isn't the right thing to do. And so he said he didn't do it. Strength of character comes from a true and deep closeness to God. We have principles that teach us about character. We have, you know, seminars on integrity and character development, doing all the right things. But, you know, for believers, it's actually easier. We are driven, when we're close with God, we're driven to be pleasing in his sight. We're driven to honor him. We want to do things the way he would want them done. And so that relationship then helps us settle some of these kind of questionable deals. It's not that he couldn't buy the land. He just understood, no, I'm not going to. I mean, obviously you could say, well, he could have bought the land, and then when the prices went up, sell it back to him, but we're just not going to make it complicated. We're not going to be at a point where, you know, can be accused. Verse 17, at my table were 150 Jews and rulers, besides those who came to us from the nations around us. Now that which was prepared daily was one ox, 6 choice sheep. Also fowl were prepared for me, and once every 10 days an abundance of all kinds of wine. Yet in spite of this, I did not demand the governor's provisions, get this, because the bondage was heavy on this people. So in other words, what he prepared was pretty minimal. It was not what would be on your per diem, your what they should have, the government employees could have exacted. They got this, and he did not add to it the governor's provisions. Because the bonding, he said, man, he was in the trenches with them. Really unique among leaders. Verse 19, remember me, my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people. It's interesting as you read through this, as we go through it together, you'll see oftentimes he did it in chapter 1. It was a little longer, but we see it in chapter 2. He just interjects his prayer. He's talking to King Artaxerxes, and Artaxerxes, what do you want to do? And it just says, I prayed. So he has this mindset of being able to come boldly before God in a very conscious state, even though he's in this one place. And here he says, you know, remember me, O God. You know, it's a part of like, Lord, I know you see this. It's not like he's saying, hey, God, did you see how good I did? Look, God, I did it your way. He's just saying, remember me, Lord. You know, I know you know. It's not like he felt God would forget and he's kind of busy, you know, putting rings on Saturn or something. You know what I mean? It's like he knew, and he's like, remember me. May that be your honest, sincere prayer. Because when you can say, remember me, O God, and you believe and know that God knows all things better than you know anything, when you say that, you're letting him shine the microscope or the scope of grace and truth and justice into your life, and he can bring correction. If you say, or I say, remember me, oh God, for this, he's like, yes, Dan, thank you. That was a beautiful commitment and wonderful service. But I want to tell you something. You did it for notoriety. You did it for position. And I'd like to purify that from your heart. And I believe that is Nehemiah's mindset. We know that as we move along. So let's move on into chapter 6. We'll get partway through this. we can see by topic or maybe categorization, chapter 5 was dealing with problems within. The way the enemy, he cannot indwell you as a born-again Christian, but he can influence you. And the way that you counter that influence is you become more influenced by God than you are by the prince of this age. It was asked one time of a man, I'll shorten the story, but he had two dogs and he used them for fighting up in Alaska. And they asked him, you know, you have these two dogs, how do you know which one's going to win? Just the one I feed the most. The one I feed the most. Do I feed the flesh or do I feed the spirit? Because in the battle, the flesh in this life, the flesh and the spirit are at enmity. They're opposed to one another. They're opposites. So which one is stronger? I know it's oversimplification, but it's a really essential thing. The one you feed is the one that's stronger. So it's encouragement to you to stay in the word, stay humble before God. Now, it happened in verse 1 of chapter 6. In other words, then this started taking place. Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies heard that I had rebuilt the wall and that there were no breaks left in it, though at the time I had not hung the doors and the gates. Then Sanballat and Geshem sent to me, saying, come, let us meet together among the villages in the plain of Ono. But they thought to do me harm. So these guys we've seen in chapter 4, and we've seen them, I think, chapter 3. They're the ones that seen that they were really agitated because somebody was concerned for the welfare of the Jews. It just infuriated them that this guy was willing to help the Jews, even though he was a Jew. And so they now are back on the scene again here, and they heard that he rebuilt the wall. In other words, they were shocked that they got the job done, because this process has been, the rebuilding of the walls has been probably well over 80 years, if they've been there 100. And so, and no reasonable progress has been gained. And now we're going to see in the latter part of the, or actually start of the next chapter, that they got this all done in like 52 days, which is just shocking. And so they're seeing, the enemies are seeing this progress, and they're going, oh man, they're actually getting it done. And he it's interesting clarification. We haven't had the gate, we've got the walls up, but we got a lot of gates. So there's a lot of access still. So we got a lot of risk, but the enemy's seen it. And they said, hey, let's meet together in the villages of the plain of Ono. But they thought to do me harm. He knew that there was no reason to leave the work, because the adversary says, hey, could we get together and talk about what you're doing there? They might have flattered him. You know, man, you're so good. This has been stalled for so long, for decades. And now here you, Mr. Do-It-All, Nehemiah, get her done her. Man, what a cool thing. Whatever he picked up on, they sought to do me no harm. I love the name of this valley. Oh, no. That was his answer. It's like, hey, let's meet over here. In the... Oh, no. Yeah, we're not going there. I'm not going to. And so notice what happened. So I sent messengers to them saying, I'm doing a great work so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and go down to you? He didn't tell them details. You don't need to tell enemies details. You give them bare minimum. Just to not, hey, I'm doing some, I'm busy right now, and there's no reason I should put my hands down from what I'm doing to come down there to do whatever it is you want to do. So it may even have been somewhat cordial to them, but they're not going to quit. They're going to try and move on. It's just a good lesson to you. You know, sometimes you just, you know, the least said is the easiest mended. Sometimes just the minimum, just, and then deal with what you have to as the timing would be. Right. Verse 4, but they sent me this message 4 times, and I answered them in the same manner. Then Sanballat sent his servant to me as before, the 5th time, and get this, with an open letter in his hand. In other words, it was more official, and it was more, you know, broad for others to read. And it was written, verse 6, it's reported among the nations, says Geshem, or, that you and the Jews plan to rebel. Therefore, according to these rumors, you are rebuilding the wall that you may be their king. And you have also appointed prophets to proclaim concerning you at Jerusalem, saying, there's a king in Judah. Now these matters will be reported to the king. So come, therefore, and let us consult together. I don't know who this Geshem, or some of your translations say Gashmu. I don't know who he was. I think it was a person of influence. His name means rain, but it was a name dropping. Did that make sense? Hey, Geshem, this regional guy, whatever he is, this is what the word is. This is what's being said. You probably have been there at times when someone names drops, and it's like, well, this person said that this. And he wasn't even stirred by it. Verse 8, then I said to him, no such things as you are being done, or as you say are being done, but you invent them in your own heart. Notice verse 9, for they are all trying to make us afraid, saying their hands will be weakened in the work and it will not be done. Once again, we see a prayer, a little short sentence. Now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. So in the midst of God, this is all just accusation and interruption. God, strengthen my hands. They knew this tactic, and we know it, because many of us have experienced it. When we have to deal with the opposition coming in and the accusations and the threat and the building fear, it takes us away from the work that we were doing. And there's times you just got to say, you know what? That's not true, and I've got things to do. And that's literally what he basically is saying. They were all trying to weaken them in the work to be done. Verse 10. Afterward, I came to the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was a secret informer. And he said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. Indeed, at night they will come to kill you. No, so now it's a threat on his life, a story report, because he already knew they were planning things. Those were interrupted, as we've seen in chapter 4. And so now this new plan has come to him, an informer, someone that's concerned for Nehemiah. Hey, just looking out for you, bro. We should go do this. This is what's going down. Verse 10 or 11, and I said, should such a man as I flee? And who is there such as I who would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. Then I perceived that God had not sent him at all, but that he had pronounced this prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. For this reason he was hired, that I should be afraid and act that way and sin, so they might have cause for an evil report that they might reproach me. God actually gives him this insight, and I believe he gives it to him. I just lean to this when he said, I will not be a party of your shenanigans, of your scam. I'm not playing. No. He stood on his convictions, and when he stood on his conviction, what was right, he's like, you guys are just making this up. You're trying this angle that you would want to trick me into doing that, and then I could be accused for going into the temple. Oh, this man of strength and character and integrity is hiding over there in the temple, and then he would sin. And he's like, no, I'm not. And that's not. So God gave him a glimpse of really what was unfolding before him. Look at verse 14. My God, remember Tobiah and Sanballat according to these their works, and the prophetess Noadiah, and the rest of the prophets who would have made me afraid. So there was those that had titles but didn't know their position. They were prophets. They were false prophets. They were ones who would say in a convincing way, in that vernacular wording, thus saith the Lord. They would use some terminology that would convince Nehemiah God has sent them to protect him. Christians actually have a similar technique. They fall to it. Hey, I was praying the other night, and the Lord spoke to me and told me to tell you too. I had a guy come to me one time, a lady come to me one time. We're in the other building. And say, hey, man, I've been praying, and the Lord spoke to me last night that he wants to join these two churches, your church and this other church, and bring them together to make a stronger presence in the community. And I'm like, okay. First of all, when I hear from him, we'll have confirmation. So cool. Okay. But then I said, I'm wondering which pastor is going to lead? Oh, you would rotate each week. And I'm like, do you know that anything in nature that has two heads is a freak? I mean, that doesn't make sense. I didn't think that until they'd said that. But here, their persuasion, and I just think they were very immature or young and not knowledgeable of the word. But they were trying to convince me because what they wanted was their congregation to be stronger and ours was growing. So it made sense. Let's just join the two together and call it one. And hey, it'll work out good. So you may have figured out we didn't... I never heard from the Lord to do that. We never went forward. Always be careful when someone says, the Lord spoke to me. The Lord told me to tell you. You may hear, the Lord told me to tell you, or I really wanted to share this with you. And they share a word of encouragement or exhortation or strengthening you in your walk. You receive that through prayer. Just, okay, I'll chew on that. I'll give you a verse and they'll tell you a location. Chew on that. But if they're telling you to do something that God hasn't told you to do yet, and it's that just like this, just say, you know what? When I hear from the Lord, I'll talk. Yeah, you can do a homework. Peter and Cornelius in the book of Acts. God spoke to Peter that Cornelius is coming. He spoke to Cornelius, says go. He gets there. Peter goes with Cornelius, and we see the work of God because he spoke to both parties. Real quickly, if a guy says to a woman, the Lord spoke to me, you're supposed to marry me, then that woman should say, wow, interesting. When I hear from the Lord, I'll call you. Until then, I'll change my number. You know, literally, it should be almost that firm because I hear some of this silly, I mean, it's not silly, it's sad because it's so hyper-carnal and manipulative. And it's all blaming God, saying he did it. So anyway, let's continue on. We can wrap this up here. Just finish this chapter out. In verse 15, so the wall was finished on the 25th day of Elul in 52 days. It's just like a little blurb. Yeah, it was done in 52 days. Decades of nothing. And in 52 days, and if you reference back to chapter 3, when you see, you know, how everyone come together, and even in chapter 2 where it says, let us rise and build. It was not Nehemiah who told the people, let's rise and build. It was the people that said to Nehemiah, because they were knit together in what God was doing, let us rise and build. And so in 52 days, they get these walls up. And it happened when all of our enemies heard it and all the nations around us saw these things, they were very disheartened in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was done by our God. May our efforts and our work and the things that we as a group put our hand to, may it be something that even the non-believers and not yet believers in our community will go, maybe they'll probably say it this way, dude, that has to be God, because those guys aren't smart enough or coordinated enough to get that much done. That's kind of what they're saying. And it wasn't just flippant. It was like, no, seriously, look at how far they got. You know, my grandpa was here, and they didn't make it down through that one section. And here in 52 days, they finished the whole stinking wall. You know, they were shocked and really afraid because they knew this God they mocked. And that's what all this was about, mocking God. They mocked the instruments, but their focus was literally they were mocking God. This God they mocked now proved himself to be active and resident and present in their area, in Jerusalem. Verse 17, and also in those days, the nobles of Judah sent many letters to Tobiah, and the letters of Tobiah came to them. Did you catch that? The nobles of Judah, which would be Jewish, sent many letters to Tobiah. He's one of the three stupidios that's been listed on this whole thing as we went through. They're still engaging and interacting, and there's this odd, like, covert thing taking place, much like our politics and politics in the world right now. For many in Judah were pledged to him because he was son-in-law of Shechaniah, the son of Ara, and his son Jehohanan had married the daughter of Meshulam, the son of Berechiah. All that to say, they had these family ties that interfered with the work of God. There seemed to be a connection that God had brought, and it wasn't a connection that God had brought. It was actually an act of the enemy and a way to manipulate by family lines and infiltrate and interfere with what God would do. Also, they reported his good deeds before me and reported words to him. Tobiah sent letters to frighten me. So there's even those within the working of the wall, in the work that's taken place, in an amazing accomplishment, that are informants to Tobiah. they're actually undermining the leadership of Nehemiah, and they're telling Tobiah, and then Tobiah is sending back letters to frighten him, and he's sending back letters with detail because he has informants on the inside, and it's enough detail that they're trying to persuade Nehemiah into stopping what he's doing. Because if they can take down the leader, they can interfere with the work. And so it's interesting. Now, what's a leader? Any one of us, someone who has influence. We see different elements and aspects and levels, so to speak, not of leadership. In the body of Christ, there's equality, not superiority, but there's also order and authority. And so we're equal with different responsibility. But we all have influence in family members, friends, coworkers, neighbors. And so this tactic will be tried. There'll be someone who says, this person said, and they'll have enough detail that you'll want to bite on it. But I have a hobby I really enjoy doing. It's fishing. And what you're doing fishing is you're trying to trick fish. You're throwing something tasty out in front of them, but you're hiding a barbed hook in the bait. And then when they take the bait, because it looks right, it looks good, then you give free lip piercings and jerk them into the boat. And if you're hungry, you pull their guts out and eat them, you know. So in the spiritual sense, they're fishing. They're trying to take him down, trying to gut him and make him ineffective. So aren't you glad none of that happens in the world you live in? You know, in Ecclesiastes, it's a very powerful statement, and it's something to constantly ponder. There's nothing new under the sun. There's nothing new. It's a different variety and a different season. It's not new. This deception and all the things that are taking place and all the, it's still there. There's a spiritual battle. It's a spiritual battle. And it came to humanity in the Garden of Eden, and we're dealing with the consequences and the ongoing battle ever since. And it'll be that way until we depart here into the very presence of God, either individually at our own, at God's timing, or collectively at this time when he calls the church to be with him and allows the enemy of our souls to then bring, you know, disaster upon this land. God too will pour out his wrath upon the Christ-rejecting world during the tribulation period. We will be removed, his bride, and then he will allow the world to experience a little bit of what they're demanding. Right now, the world is demanding we don't need God. Matter of fact, it's saying it in this way. You know what? Give us some time with Stargate. You know what Stargate is? You'll research it now. So basically, it's just big data centers, massive, and there's several of them being built. Because with AI, we can have Tower of Babel 2.0. We can actually reach God. We can get by on our own. And anyway, I'm just baiting you because I'm going to teach on that one of these days because it's really, I'm excited about this crazy time we live in. So let's pray. God, thank you for your word tonight. Such a beautiful just walkthrough. We just got to catch history as it's happening, and yet we know it's cliche and catchy, but it's history, but it's his story. It's your story for us, that we would learn from those things that have happened, that we not repeat them. The things that have taken place are for our admonition and our instruction. And so give us that sensitivity to your voice and awareness of your presence. Give us a conscious awareness of your love, that we would be compelled to live for you in love and not obligation, that we would be disciplined people, wise in this world, kind and compassionate like you are. But we would be focused people as well, committed, knowing that we are in a battle. And you've called us and equipped us. You've empowered us to fight your fight, for you are the one who leads us. Thank you, Jesus, in your name. Amen. All right. Well, thank you for joining in. And we now can say we've finished chapter 6.